My name is Nicole Kidman, and I've wanted to do a rom-com for so long, and along came A Family Affair. It's a great romantic comedy, and it's laugh out loud. If you feel like, I just need to curl up and watch something that feels very comforting, it's the Netflix experience. There's laughter and there's joy. That's A Family Affair.
A Family Affair, starring Nicole Kidman, Zac Efron, and Joey King. Directed by Richard LeGravenais. Rated PG-13. Sexual content, partial nudity, and some strong language. Now playing only on Netflix.
HD Smartcast.
You are listening to a Mint production, brought to you by HD Smartcast.
Hello, welcome to our podcast, The Signal
and the Noise,
that will attempt to give you a peek into the inner workings of Mint's long story. This is Sunit.
And I am Ajay.
And we are both editors with Mint.
Every week, either one of us will attempt to walk you through the most defining development in the world of business, politics, or technology.
Let's dive in.
Welcome and thanks for tuning in. COVID-19 is once again on everyone's radar. Unlike in Western countries, India had somehow managed to escape a winter surge. And things were looking fine for nearly 4 long months. But virus cases are surging once again. Coincidentally, the second wave comes in the backdrop of the first anniversary of an unprecedented lockdown, which went into effect on 25 March 2020. A year on, have we learned enough lessons? Can we now live near normal lives and still manage to cope with COVID? Will there be more lockdowns? And what are some of the big mysteries that still remain with regard to COVID-19? Joining me to unpack those questions is Srinath Reddy, a well-known expert on public health and the head of the Public Health Foundation of India. Good afternoon and welcome to the show, Srinath.
Good afternoon.
So let me start by just looking at what has happened over the last 1 year. It's exactly a year since India went into lockdown in late March 2020. What do you think are some of the big learnings about this pandemic from as well as an economic perspective?
Well, you basically have asked about health as well as economy, and each of them have been affected together. Of course, there are some areas that we need to focus on for each of them, even though they have been intertwined. Firstly, let me look at the health issue. Clearly, what we have learned is that unless you have an efficient and equitable health system functioning reliably in a steady state, it is difficult to build up a very swift and strong surge response across all levels of care, suddenly when you're faced with a public health emergency. We did cope. We did build up our reserves as fast as we could, but it would have helped a great deal if we had already a strong health system that is existing at all levels of care, especially the primary health care, particularly urban and rural primary health care, because much of the COVID case detection, referral for testing, home care, contact tracing, all of these functions would have had to be done at the level of primary health care. So only the focus on ventilators and advanced care that preoccupied our attention in the early stages, and even the district hospitals which were neglected and which could have provided a lot of care for hospitalized patients with just oxygen, even they were not fully ready. So these are the lessons that we must have for the future, that unless you have a well-resourced healthcare system at all levels of care and well-connected as well for referral and especially good emergency care services through good connectivity, and also surveillance systems with pandemic preparedness, self-reliance in terms of a number of areas, of whether it's testing kits or personal protection equipment, or even other forms of equipment, we definitely needed a lot more of prior planning and preparedness. But you also asked me about the economy.
Right.
Clearly, a well-functioning public health system is the best protection to the economy. That is your kavach. Because if you are actually going to be derailed in your economy because of a public health emergency, you have lockdowns, you have people falling sick, you have people being confined in their movement, trade and travel are restricted, obviously the economy is going to take a nosedive. So if we do not resource our health system adequately, both finances and health workforce, and bring in efficiency into our health system on a regular basis, the economy will constantly be threatened. I believe we can keep the economy open. That's what we have learned now. If you take sufficient precautions and maintain discipline, we can start our workplaces, provided we observe some precautions. We can start our schools and colleges, provided we observe some precautions. So the discipline is required, which is following public health advisories, if you still want to keep the economy going. And these are absolutely important. And finally, I would like to say one key lesson is that even to give a boost to the economy, not only you need to preserve and promote health, but once you expand the health workforce to fill the very many gaps that exist, it offers huge employment opportunities, and increased employment and livelihoods in the health sector can certainly give a boost to a sagging economy.
Okay. So 1 year on, we have learned several things about this virus and how we can deal with the pandemic. But do you think there are still some big mysteries that remain as we head into what's increasingly looking like a second wave?
Yes, certainly there are some mysteries. Like we are seeing definitely that in terms of the virus, we still do not know fully well about the asymptomatic cases, how many of them are really affected in a truly asymptomatic manner. And unless you do a huge mass testing, you will not be able to really find out. And even our antibody surveys are not really that extensive nationally. Secondly, we do not know about, chronic COVID or long-term COVID consequences. What are the consequences over a period of time? How quickly do people recover, even if they seem to have symptoms persisting after 2 to 3 months? And we do not also know how the mutants are behaving and whether the mutants are homegrown or not. And what about the mutants that are coming from abroad? Are they only spreading faster? Are they more virulent? Are they less virulent? These are all the questions that we still do not have a very clear-cut answer to.
I'll add one more to that, which is why is the second wave happening now? Most people expected it to happen if there was a surge to happen around winter. So why, as we head into summer, is there a second wave?
Firstly, I think in terms of the people who are susceptible in the large urban areas, the cities and the surrounding districts which were highly urbanized, many of the susceptible people were indeed infected. But there were also travel restrictions, there were restrictions on crowding, and people, some of them, if not all of them, were taking some personal precautions of masks, etc. But once we had the euphoria misplaced, that suddenly we have attained herd immunity, and therefore the epidemic is a matter of the past, we can do what we want in terms of large crowded events, which are super spreader events, and particularly gathering in either indoor events or even outdoor in large static crowds assembling together for hours and political rallies or religious gatherings. Once that behavior pattern changed of people and even enforcement became extremely lax, and then the virus got a second wind and an opportunity to spread faster. Of course, the mutants could have contributed as well. We still do not have a clear-cut assessment of to what extent the mutants have contributed. But I would certainly say it is the laxity on our behavior which has actually created an opportunity for the virus to rear its head again. Okay. And that's been true elsewhere too in the world. You've seen so many countries prematurely declaring victory. Europe, for example, they opened up. They had bars and restaurants being flooded. In fact, in the UK, they started giving discounts for people patronizing their restaurants because they wanted to revive the economy. Then you have seen other super spreader events of people gathering in nightclubs and bars and beaches. And those countries have now, again, started experiencing huge surges. So it should not be a surprise that India too pays a price, though fortunately for us, the price has not been very heavy in terms of deaths. It still pays a price for that kind of carelessness.
I understand. So I just wanted to run through, apart from public action or lockdowns or curfews, which some cities are already doing, I wanted to run through a few things about what people can personally do. And I want to get your take on it. Do you think an ordinary person should attend a large public gathering or a political rally? Would you advise against it? What would be your take?
I would most certainly advise against it.
Okay, a mall? Going to a mall or a restaurant?
Well, I would say that go to an open air area or a well ventilated place and try and do it mostly during the daytime if possible. And do not really start spending too much time in an indoor crowded place, particularly if it is ill ventilated. Because wind flow matters, sunlight matters, and crowding certainly is not helpful. So I think you have to be cautious. You have to play with certain degree of care and caution, even if you are trying to get back to your social life.
Okay. The last thing I wanted to ask is about schools and colleges. Some of them have just started opening. What would be your advice?
Well, I would say that we have to resume life, and particularly I am concerned about school education being denied to a large number of people who are not able to access digital services with the same ease as some of the richer people can. And even if a poor family can have digital access to a smartphone, and it's usually the boy who gets it and the girl is deprived. And therefore, the digital divide goes a long way, both across families and within families. So I want the schools to be reopened. So I believe, firstly, the school personnel, the teachers, the school staff, the transport staff who take the children to the schools, all of them must be immunized on priority as essential workers. Then in the schools itself, if we can have shift system, if we can also have much better ventilation made possible as much as possible, then I think we ought to be able to resume our school activities sooner than later.
Okay. So looking ahead at the second wave, and you also referred to some Western countries, that in most places it has been worse than the first wave. And already in India, the rate of increase in reported COVID infections in a place like Bombay is much faster than what we witnessed last summer. So what should India really be preparing for in the meantime?
Well, I think we are going to be seeing more cases. And if the virus remains at the same level of virulence, then we will certainly see more hospitalizations and unfortunately some more deaths. But it is possible, as is being reported by doctors in Mumbai, that actually they are seeing a less virulent form of the clinical manifestations. Right now, we do not have a clue whether the virus has actually changed its form, but at least in terms of the behavior, whether it is because we are better prepared in terms of our health system response, or actually the virus is spreading faster but is causing less havoc to the body, less virulent, we do not know. But it does make evolutionary biology sense, because a virus, when it is actually exhausting or it's depleting the number of susceptible individuals that it can attack, when those numbers are getting limited, and also we are placing barriers in its path by way of masks and also vaccines now, and to some extent avoiding crowds, though it's not successfully done fully, when the virus has to continue its own existence, it then changes to a form which is far more infectious but less virulent, because then it cannot afford to exhaust the host community. So even in Europe and elsewhere, you're seeing that the virus is spreading faster, but certainly it appears to be less virulent in terms of the health effects. We'll have to wait and see whether how much of that is because of the change in the virus characteristics and behavior, and how much of it is because of our better public health and healthcare systems responsiveness, because we are better prepared after a year. So as far as we are concerned, we should keep our public health precautions still going very strongly in terms of personal precautions as well as public action in order to prevent super spreader events, and at the same time vaccinate much faster.
Okay, that's something that I wanted to ask about, whether we are doing the vaccinations at the rate which is necessary or adequate at this time in the pandemic. Referring to the US, after the change in administration there, they seem to have ramped up their vaccination pretty remarkably and within a few weeks. So I was just wondering if India should, is there anything for us to learn from what other countries are doing?
See, as far as the US is concerned, they have actually managed it much better because they have control over a huge amount of vaccines. And to some extent, their delivery system has been fairly well geared up, both to public and private sector combining together. But even there, and even in the UK, where the rates have been fairly high, they have also followed an orderly system of eligibility, of getting the most essential workers, the healthcare workers and other essential workers, vaccinated first. And then people who are vulnerable on the ground of age or other disease conditions, vaccinated next. Because the purpose of these vaccines at the moment, those which are available, the systemic intramuscular vaccines, are firstly to prevent serious disease. To some extent, they can prevent infection transmission, but that evidence is not very clear. What we know for sure is that they seem to prevent severe disease, and therefore preventing vulnerable people from getting affected and keeping essential workers healthy enough so that they can continue to function for services of society, that is the first priority. So we do need to do that. But I believe if we can actually increase our walk-in facilities, if we can increase our community connect so that people who are eligible can be quickly be mobilized, their vaccine confidence can be built up so that their doubts are removed, concerns are addressed, then we can certainly increase our vaccination rates much faster. And then, of course, we must bring it down to other age groups as well. But first, protect the most vulnerable and the most essential, but expand that effort much more vigorously.
Okay. In terms of mitigation, I also, one particular thing I want to ask you is about is the night curfew, which many cities and states are imposing now, which we saw even last year. I just want to understand, is there a logic to the night curfew?
Well, if you want to give a logic, you can certainly provide a logic to that, and I try and do that. I'm not saying that that's going to be a magic wand or the most effective measure, but there is a certain amount of logic behind it. Firstly, what happens in the night is people tend to crowd indoors in restaurants, bars, entertainment places. And that actually causes a huge problem in terms of super spreader events. Because people are not walking through a market. They will be going into malls which are open in the night, or cinema halls which are open in the night, and worse still, bars and restaurants which are open in the night to have celebratory events. Second element is the weather is cooler. And when the weather is cooler and the air is cooler, it doesn't flow as fast. It doesn't rise as fast. So virus clouds, which can form when people mingle, do not disperse as easily because the wind flow conditions are altered compared to the daytime. When the wind is warmer and rises faster, and therefore the clouds disperse from the ground level. Third, in the daytime, there is ultraviolet light. Therefore, the time for the virus to survive is also much less than in the night, where the virus doesn't have the threat of the ultraviolet light. So, for multiple reasons, you can actually have an accentuated danger in the nighttime if people mingle together in a crowded condition. So, that is why I suppose night curfew is helpful to that extent.
So finally, I just wanted to ask you also about what comes after the pandemic, although we are still in the middle of a second wave and possibly a few more months. Nobody knows how long this is going to last. But based on the 1920s experience, the last big flu, many analysts are already predicting, you know, as and when things stabilize, we're going to go back to roaring economic growth, there's going to be a boost in consumption, and people might even travel a lot more. Do you have a sense of what comes after a big global health crisis?
Well, the 1920s were somewhat different, though we can still revive the roaring 20s if you want to. Because remember, it not only came after a huge flu pandemic, it also came after a big world war. And therefore, firstly, two things happened. One is, for unfortunate reasons, the industry gets a big boost during wartime, and that gives a kickstart to the economy. Secondly, after a war and after a pandemic, people did want to travel, and the spirit of optimism from the recovery of from both actually gave people an opportunity to really become much more entrepreneurial and active. Now, we fortunately do not have such a world war situation, but we do have a pandemic situation from which once we recover, certainly tourism will take a big boost because people would just want to travel, sure. The hospitality industry, the hotels, the restaurants, all of them will get a definite boost. How long it will last, we'll see. But certainly there will be a revival. But very importantly, we must also recognize that we must invest in the economy as we go forward. Because first thing is we must protect health so that the economy doesn't keep slipping on the banana peels of health disasters. Secondly, by expanding health workforce and expanding the health sector, we are going to really gear up our employment. A lot more people can be engaged in the health sector in India and even globally to meet the health workforce needs. Third, we must recognize that these pandemics do not happen by accident. Our deforestation and ecological despoilation is setting up conveyor belts for viruses and vectors confined in the forest animals to travel to captive live veterinary populations of livestock and other poultry, etc., and also to human beings. So we are setting up those conveyor belts to that deforestation. So if we actually are much more ecologically responsible, we will be able to actually protect the economy. But I see a future for green technologies because both climate change and also from the point of view of preventing pandemics, we ought to adopt much more of environmental friendly policies and environment friendly technologies. So I see a great future for green technologies in the economy. So health, our economy will ride on health and environment together. And that is how we must proceed. Even, I mean, digital revolution and artificial intelligence, all of them are fine. But unless you protect health and protect the environment, all the technological advances in other fields will fail to get you either into a stable economy or a stable society.
Right. Well, let's hope we take all the right lessons from this and come out of this stronger, Srinath. But thanks for joining and thanks for shedding light on some of these topics. It was really great talking to you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You have been listening to The Signal and the Noise. We would love to hear from you. Reach out to us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram on @HTSmartcast.
Or you can also reach out to us personally at Sunit Arora
and @AJAxiom. To listen to more such interesting podcasts, do log on to htsmartcast.com.
We'll be back next week with a new story, another fresh voice, or a unique take on the world.
Do stay well until then and keep supporting good journalism.
This was a Mint production brought to you by HT Smartcast.
HT Smartcast.
My name is Nicole Kidman, and I've wanted to do a rom-com for so long, and along came A Family Affair. It's a great romantic comedy, and it's laugh out loud. If you feel like, I just need to curl up and watch something that feels very comforting, it's the Netflix experience. There's laughter and there's joy. That's A Family Affair.
A Family Affair, starring Nicole Kidman, Zac Efron, and Joey King. Directed by Richard LeGravenaise. Rated PG-13. Sexual content, partial nudity, and some strong language. Now playing only on Netflix.